Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sarah Anderson of the Institute for Policy Studies, who explains why the Trump and Republican Party plan to cut taxes for profitable corporations won't produce jobs or boost the U.S. economy. Norman Solomon, co-founder and coordinator of the online activist group RootsAction.org, who assesses the current battle over the future direction of the Democratic Party. And Reed Miller with the LGBTQ prisoner support group Black and Pink, who discusses their work toward the abolition of the prison industrial complex and empowering their incarcerated members. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While the destruction wrought by Hurricanes Harvey and Irma has been the focus of attention here in the U.S., massive monsoon rains in India, Nepal, and Bangladesh in late August killed 1,400 people, closed over 20,000 schools, and wiped out crops and livestock for poor farmers in South Asia. Mumbai, India's financial capital, was paralyzed, and receding floodwaters have exposed the population to diseases including diarrhea, malaria, and dengue. Like flood-ravaged Houston, big cities in India have permitted massive development on wetlands and floodplains. Uncontrolled development has eliminated ponds, lakes, and backwaters that ordinarily absorb and decrease the destructive power of heavy rains and storm surges. In Mumbai and Chennai, nearly 2 million people were displaced by floods in 2015. Wetlands researcher T.V. Ramachandra of the Indian Institute of Science declared that recent urban flooding during extreme weather events are mostly man-made. These are not natural disasters, he said. The city of Bangalore has tripled in size over the last 30 years as the average temperature in the city has risen half a degree centigrade. Bangalore, which now floods regularly, lost more than 2,500 lakes to development. Since June, over 21 nations, including African nations Ghana, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Sierra Leone, have experienced extreme weather events such as monsoon rains, mudslides, and hurricanes. The Guardian newspaper reports that the wealthy elite of oil-rich Azerbaijan ran a covert $3 billion operation to influence European journalists and politicians, with accounts of money laundering through a network of secretive British companies. The goal of the scheme was to brighten up Azerbaijan's global image and counter accusations of massive human rights abuses, corruption, and election rigging. According to leaked bank records, over 16,000 payments were made between 2012 and 2014. Danske, one of Europe's largest banks, processed the transactions through its branch in Estonia. The leaked documents implicated several former members of the Council of Europe's Parliamentary Assembly known as PACE, who rejected a critical human rights report on Azerbaijan in 2013. In response to the investigation, the Council of Europe's Assembly quickly inserted language into the new human rights report, urging Azerbaijan President Ilham Aliyev to launch an independent inquiry into the multi-billion-dollar money laundering scheme. Federal prosecutors in Michigan have, for the first time, prosecuted a case involving female genital mutilation, or FGM, in the American courts. The charges relate to 2 7-year-old girls who were sent by their parents to a clinic in Livonia, Michigan, for an FGM procedure. 6 people have been indicted, and the clinic was closed down. The investigation has expanded to include targets in both Minneapolis and Los Angeles. FGM is a ritual followed by numerous cultural and religious groups across the developing world. Defense lawyers maintain that the case revolves around freedom of religion and may eventually be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. A trial in the case is expected to begin in October, when a district court judge must weigh claims of religious freedom versus the government's duty to protect children from abuse. Legal observers told the Christian Science Monitor that federal prosecutors must produce evidence to back up their claims that FGM causes substantial physical and mental harm to girls. Richard Sedler, a constitutional law professor at Wayne State University in Detroit, observed, "Religious freedom does not include the right to do things that we all consider harmful to children. The World Health Organization considers FGM to be a human rights violation, and the practice has been banned in the United States since 1995. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
During the 2016 election campaign, Donald Trump promised to pass the biggest tax cut since Ronald Reagan's $200 billion tax reduction in 1981. While the administration hasn't yet produced a detailed proposal, analysis of the broad outlines of the plan found that their tax cuts would disproportionately benefit the wealthiest Americans and the billionaire and millionaire members of Trump's own cabinet. While Trump has refused to release his federal tax returns, it's a safe bet that he himself, as well as his luxury real estate development company, would be primary beneficiaries of the tax reform plan. In line with long-standing Republican dogma, the rationale for cutting corporate taxes is to make more capital available to companies so they can invest, create more jobs, and boost the economy for all Americans. The only trouble is that the standard GOP trickle-down philosophy has for many years been solidly debunked by economists who have researched the real-world impact of tax cuts on job creation. While Trump and Republicans denounce the current top U.S. tax rate of 35% as being the highest in the world, the Government Accountability Office found that between 2008 and 2012, profitable large corporations paid on average an effective tax rate of only 14% due to built-in loopholes within the federal tax code. Your reporter spoke with Sarah Anderson, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Global Economy Project. Here she talks about why corporate tax cuts don't produce more jobs, as detailed in Anderson's recent New York Times op-ed piece.
Many people have looked at this question of whether slashing the corporate tax rate will be good for job creation, but our research is a little different in that we looked at specific companies that have already been paying next to nothing in federal income taxes. And AT&T jumped out as really an extreme example of a company that has been avoiding paying their fair share of taxes using the tax savings not to create jobs. They've actually been slashing jobs, but putting a lot of it into executive compensation. So specifically, we looked at companies that were profitable every year over the period 2008 to 2015, and yet were paying an effective tax rate of less than 20%. The official rate is 35%, and AT&T was actually paying only an 8% effective federal tax rate during that period. And what did they do with the tax savings? Well, instead of creating jobs, they laid off nearly 80,000 people, and their CEO, Randall Stephenson, has made quite a fortune during this period. And what amazed me is that he's out there very vocally promoting Trump's tax cut plan and bemoaning, you know, how burdensome the current tax code is and how much more competitive they could be if only they had to pay less taxes. And they're already paying next to nothing in taxes. So I think with these specific examples, it'll be even more clear to people that this is just a hoax, this idea that cutting the corporate tax rate will lead to more jobs.
Sarah, what do you make of the media coverage of this very narrow part of the debate where an advocate of cutting taxes for the wealthy and big corporations always tell us that the United States has the highest tax rate in the entire world, which sounds, you know, oh my God, how could we be doing such a horrible thing to our corporate brothers and sisters? So how do you think that's generally handled by the hosts of these talk shows, particularly on cable news, where a lot of people get their information?
Yeah, they usually eat it right up. So I'm really appreciative of shows like yours where we get the chance to dispel some of these myths. The official corporate tax rate in the U.S. is 35% at the federal level, but the rate is meaningless because there are so many loopholes in the tax code that most big corporations don't pay anywhere near that. And so even though the rate might be high relative to a lot of other countries, the amount of revenue that our government gets from corporate taxes is lower than the average for industrialized countries. So that is another huge myth you're going to hear over and over again from President Trump, from House Speaker Ryan. It's another mantra of the Republican Party that our corporations are just, you know, being strangled by these high taxes that are so much higher than anywhere else in the world.
And Sarah, I wanted to ask you, with the discussion we see now unfolding in Washington about tax reform and the need to create a fairer system, what are some of the proposals that you would recommend for genuine tax reform that would benefit the majority and not just the wealthiest 1% and the most profitable corporations?
Yeah, well, the focus should really be on closing up the loopholes that are currently allowing these big profitable corporations to get away with paying so little in taxes. And this whole, you know, game around hiding profits offshore is one that would, you know, raise tremendous amounts of revenue. And also even the playing field between these big multinational corporations that have the ability to hide their money in tax havens and domestic, you know, rooted companies and small businesses that don't have that option. But I think we also need to look at additional ways to make sure that the wealthy and big corporations and Wall Street are paying their fair share. And the one that I decided to highlight in the New York Times op-ed is a small tax on Wall Street speculation, which at a very, very low rate that would really just target the real high flyers in the financial casino, the ones who are flipping stocks and making trades thousands of times a day. Even a tax at a very small rate on each one of those trades of derivatives and so forth could really add up on these, you know, high-flying traders in the market, but have very little effect on ordinary folks and their pension funds or whatever investments they might have. And that would just be one way that I think we could make our system more fair. You know, it's amazing to think that ordinary Americans pay their taxes every year. They pay taxes when they buy a gallon of gasoline, and often if you buy basics like a new winter coat. But people who are trading millions of dollars in derivatives every minute don't pay any kind of sales tax when they're doing that kind of activity.
That was Sarah Anderson, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Global Economy Project. Find links to her August 30th New York Times op-ed piece titled, "It's a Myth That Corporate Tax Cuts Mean More Jobs," and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In Hillary Clinton's newly published book titled What Happened, she criticizes her Democratic primary opponent, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, as being an unrealistic overpromiser. She maintains that his attacks during the campaign caused lasting damage, making it harder to unify progressives in the general election and paving the way for Trump's crooked Hillary campaign. Clinton's complaints targeting progressive firebrand Sanders in her new book and in interviews shines a spotlight on the ongoing battle within the Democratic Party. The Wall Street-friendly establishment, aligned with Clinton, is locked in a struggle with the progressive wing energized by Sanders over the future direction of the Democrats. Underscoring that rift was a lawsuit filed in July 2016 against the Democratic National Committee and its former chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, which charged that leaked internal emails revealed how the DNC had worked to undermine Sanders and advance Clinton during the primary campaign. The lawsuit was recently dismissed by a federal judge on August 25th. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, co-founder and coordinator of the online activist group RootsAction.org. Here he assesses the lack of unity within the Democratic Party in this critical moment, when the Trump administration is implementing regressive policies on the economy, education, labor, reproductive rights, LGBTQ and religious discrimination, environmental protection, climate change, and immigration.
We have really, I think, two huge challenges ahead. And one is to push back against and defeat the horrific right-wing agenda. And that is really imperative for us. And at the same time, we've got to advance and implement a genuinely progressive agenda. I think one of the main dynamics that we went through last year is that it is very difficult for a corporate phony candidate who claims to be on the side of the working people to defeat a phony right-wing populist, in this case, a Donald Trump. And so it was very difficult for Hillary Clinton to make a convincing case that she was on the side of the, if you will, average person, because she was so clearly aligned with Wall Street. And to me, it really scrambles the idea and refutes the idea that, oh, you're fighting the right wing, so you've got to be taking a so-called centrist position. The people in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Ohio who provided the swing votes to put this monstrous Trump presidency into the White House were really paying attention to their economic well-being. And since then, we've seen very grudging attention from a lot of, unfortunately, the Democratic Party establishment at the top to the realities that there is a class economic war going on. And whether we want to face it or not, and I think we must, that war is being waged with more viciousness than ever from the top down. And so we can't simply say, as Democrats, for instance, oh, we really support the victims of inequality. That's not enough. That's part of what needs to be said. The other is that we are absolutely opposed to the victimizers, and we're willing to name them. That was a great strength of the Bernie Sanders campaign. He didn't just say, I identify with people who are being victimized. He called out Wall Street. He called out the big banks. He made it clear in no uncertain terms that he was dedicated to advancing an agenda to challenge this kind of what he was willing to call oligarchy. And it brings to mind Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who approximately 80 years ago said in a Madison Square Garden speech that the rich, the wealthy, those who were greedy graspers of the corporate power of the day, he said, they hate me and I welcome their hatred. And that's quite a contrast to the sort of the, unfortunately, Obama record and the Clinton record, which is, in effect, they hate me sometimes, and I want them to like me.
Norman, I wanted to ask you to comment on Hillary Clinton's point raised in some recent interviews talking about her new book. Hillary Clinton makes the point in her new book and these interviews that infighting with the Democratic Party just weakens the Democrats and provides inroads for Republicans and conservatives to keep winning elections that Democrats have infamously been losing quite a bit of lately. What do you make of that criticism?
It reminds me of a statement made by a military tactician, I believe it was von Clausewitz, who said, every conqueror is a lover of peace. When the forces that Hillary Clinton represents have won and they have dominance, then they want peace. Then they want acquiescence. But when they are challenged, when it's unclear who's going to prevail, they fight like hell. And so, of course, she doesn't think there should be infighting when her hand-picked chair of the DNC, Tom Perez, is in power, where she's trying to quiet and suppress the grassroots upsurge, which has continued since the election with the basic politics of Bernie Sanders' campaign. And so naturally, she just wants us to cool our jets and go along with her program. It ain't going to happen.
That was author and activist Norman Solomon, co-founder and coordinator of the online organization RootsAction.org. For more analysis and commentary on the struggle within the Democratic Party, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Black and Pink is a grassroots nationwide organization that supports 14,000 LGBTQ community members who are currently in prison. Their website states, "Our work toward the abolition of the prison industrial complex is rooted in the experience of currently and formerly incarcerated people. We are outraged by the specific violence of the prison industrial complex against LGBTQ people, and respond through advocacy, education, direct service, and organizing." Among other work, the group publishes and sends a monthly newsletter to its incarcerated members. The black and pink name refers to the colors of the queer anarchist flag, though not all members identify as anarchist. In Nazi Germany, gays and lesbians were labeled with pink and black triangles. The group held its second national conference in Chicago August 4th through 6th, where the theme was Celebrate, Learn, Heal, and Build, and the focus was on strengthening the movement towards abolition and the needs of LGBTQ and HIV-positive people. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Reed Miller, technology coordinator with Black and Pink, who lives in New Haven, Connecticut. Reed, who attended the Chicago conference, first explains the origins of Black and Pink, which located 14,000 LGBTQ prisoners that are currently active in the group's Pen Pal program.
Black and Pink started about 12 years ago. Our founder, Reverend Jason Lydon, who's a Unitarian Universalist minister, was incarcerated doing civil disobedience at the School of America's Watch. And as a result of his incarceration, when he got out, he wanted to stay in touch with the people who supported him while he was in prison, and he was put in what the Georgia prisons called a homo bin. And basically he started with friends over a dinner table, and they wrote to a couple dozen pen pals. And the two ways, there, I guess there's three ways that our address in Boston got around. One was, you know, some pen pals would say to other folks in prison, like, hey, these people are writing me, and if you give them your address, then they'll write you too. And so it just spread friend to friend, word of mouth like that. We're in some guides, like prisoner resource guides. So if you go to, if a prison has a law library and you look us up, you might be able to get the address. And then primarily we send out, as I mentioned, this monthly newspaper, which most of the content is submitted by our prisoner members. So they write in handwritten letters. We have several dozen volunteers every weekend processing the literally hundreds of letters we get every week, including submissions to our newspaper. So those get typed up and included in our newspaper, which is important, I should say, also because prisoners generally aren't allowed to write to one another. And as a result of the traumatic and abusive experiences they're having inside prison, feel very isolated. And so the newspaper is a way for people to connect across prisons. And really, we hear often that they think, oh, I was alone until I realized, oh, this person in Pennsylvania, here I am in Texas, is experiencing similar things, or here I'm in Florida, and wow, like, that's similar to my situation. And so for every 10 letters that we get in, we get four new people who have heard of our organization. And so we're growing at almost an exponential rate. It's just sort of limited by how many volunteers we have to process all that mail and how many funds we have to send out more and more newspapers.
So your organization just had a national meeting in Chicago.
Yeah.
So what was the focus of that, or what came out of that?
Yeah, the focus of the meeting was, since the prison system with its over 2 million people incarcerated and many more millions under probation and parole, you know, has people scattered about the country, it's an opportunity for us to get together in a centralized place to look toward our long-term goals. We are an explicitly abolitionist organization, which means that, yeah, we don't believe the prison industrial complex has the capacity to bring any sort of justice to our communities in the situation where harm is done. Of course, so much of the harm that happens in our society is rooted in the inequality driven by capitalism and the structures of power that are driven by that inequality and lack of access to resources. And that's compounded, especially for our organization, with LGBTQ folks and folks who are HIV positive, experiencing, when they're not in prison, extreme levels of discrimination, of lack of access to housing, lack of access to employment, to healthcare, and folks needing to resort to survival economies, like trading sex or trading drugs in order to get by. Other folks have caused other people harm, and we do think that in a world where transformative justice is our means of restoring justice between people, that, you know, people who cause harm to one another will have an opportunity to make amends if possible. And we don't believe in throwing people away. We want people to remain part of our communities, and we don't think that a person should be defined by the worst thing they've ever done. I don't think all of us have done bad things on some level or another, and that shouldn't define us entirely.
Does Black and Pink work with other prison abolition groups or with other LGBTQ groups to achieve your goals?
Yeah, absolutely. I think with such a behemoth like the prison industrial complex, it's completely necessary for us to work in coalition with other organizations. We work with LGBT groups on a nationwide coalition that's kind of got some mainstream folks in it and has some other more radical LGBT groups working on broad criminal justice reform as it pertains to LGBTQ folks. And so that's been an ongoing partnership for a number of years, and putting together some sort of policy proposals that, you know, some groups might be more extreme, some groups might be more mainstream, but things that we can all get around. All of these groups, we really respect the work they're doing, because it's really about working with individuals and building power toward our collective liberation. And it's also important to recognize that we're not here as like a charity for prisoners. We want to empower prisoners, and we respect the ideas and actively try and solicit ideas from our members.
That was Reed Miller with the LGBTQ prisoner support group Black and Pink. Learn more about Black and Pink's mission and projects by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WLSL in Dade City, Florida, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.